Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens, and unfortunately, Kathleen cannot be with us today. So, we have survived Halloween. We are at All Saints today. And, you know, let's hope that all of those monsters have gone back to the other side of the veil. But it is a great time to once again delve into the prominent people who are causing and leading the spirit revolution in which we live. And this is spirit revolution. This is not ghost revolution. But our special guest today is Dr. Carmen Boulter. And you might have heard of her through a very intriguing DVD called The Pyramid Code. But Carmen is so much more, and in this hour we are going to explore the soon-to-be-unveiled dimensions of Carmen, as well as the dimensions which Carmen is already notorious for. So Carmen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Philip. Nice to be here.
I saw a video presentation which you did some months ago at the Megalithomania conference in Glastonbury. Where first of all you were eloquent across the video platform from your home in Canada, but you really, I think, did something with the Pyramid Code which is new, which is something which was needed. All too often we have seen aspects of pyramids whereby, you know, they are either the Zahi Hawass kind of material, which is kind of boring and basically inaccurate, and then sometimes people who also jump to extraordinary conclusions as to what the pyramids might be. But the pyramids are there. There are people living today in Egypt who are using them as part of a, I would say, spiritual discipline, and you sought those out and you brought them in front of the camera, which I thought was extraordinarily beautiful and extraordinarily innovative. So why did you do the Pyramid Code? What was your ambition? Is it succeeding? And what really should we take away from the Pyramid Code?
Okay, three questions. First of all, it's already been in 27 countries, and there's another 26 national TV networks that are looking at it. It was on Documentary Channel, and they've asked for a second run of it, and they nominated it as Best Documentary of the Year for 2010. And so it's really gone far and wide. It's been in more countries than that by DVD, and the response on internet has been absolutely overwhelming. So I've gotten thousands and thousands of letters from people, and they say it's a breath of fresh air. And one of the most common comments is that when they finish it, they watch it again. So it's five episodes long, and I'd say that the response has been overwhelmingly positive. So I'm really happy with that. The reason that I did it was because I've been tied to Egypt since I was a little girl. I started having past life memories. I went there for the first time when I was 22 in 1977. I'm dating myself. And everything that was said by Zahi Hawass and by traditional Egyptologists just jammed inside my body somehow, and just I felt like this is not it. And then I thought, well, what is this voice inside me? And if that's not it, then what is it? And then I met Hakim about 10 years ago, who was an indigenous wisdom keeper who knew the ancient Suf language, which is the original language of ancient Egypt. And he started doing these linguistic translations, and he was getting on in years. And I thought, he's got wisdom, but he doesn't try to prove it. It's not necessarily scientific, but it has come down through the oral tradition, through his ancestors. And so I thought it was really important to get him on film. But then my motivation was to find scientists who would corroborate what he's saying and then present that with animations and with narration that was going to help people understand what he was saying. Because if you just listen to Hakim, you'd get terribly confused. So I'd say that it was to archive his work. And I'm really glad we've done that, because there's a lot more material that I didn't use because I didn't have scientists who corroborated it. And over the years, now there's more scientists speaking, as Hakim did. And so that was the motivation.
And, you know, the family, the Hakim family, continued to work with people to show the pyramids from a different perspective. And at this moment in time, Kathleen would probably jump in and say how she, several years ago, in 1994, 2003, I think, or four, she traveled to Egypt. She visited the pyramid complexes, and she met a local person very much like Hakim, whose nickname was the Fox. And after hours, he led them into one of the satellite pyramids on the Giza Plateau, let them in, and basically told them to get out. And they thought, because there were two of them, Kathleen and a friend of hers, that this would be quite easy, but it turned out to be very complex. And she realized that what was happening was really that they would only really get out if she completely surrendered herself to that moment, if she got out of her Western rationalized mindset and just was. And at that moment in time, she felt really that she was initiated. And what would otherwise have taken panic and, you know, might have taken hours, really was a rush dash. But also, when she came back to the hotel, that she really felt ill, and she was ill for a period of time because of basically the initiatory experience which had happened. And it showed to her that people today are still using those pyramid complexes for very practical purposes, for spiritual values. So having made the pyramid code, what is the answer to the code? What is there to be decoded?
Okay, well, normally we're looking through our eyes, our patriarchal eyes of domination and warring and all kinds of things and power over and that. And I think that ancient Egypt was matriarchal, and that the code inside it is to approach from a more internal perspective and from a more intuitive perspective and a spiritual perspective. And so the notion of how the ancients were initiated is something that hasn't come to the foreground. So the Great Pyramid is a multidimensional, multifunctional complex that has been there for such a long time. I think part of the code is not looking within the time frame that we've been offered. And so the Bible wants us to think we're 6,000 years old. The history books say that. And it goes back to more than one processional cycle ago. And so I think that we've been barking up the wrong tree, thinking of it as tombs for pharaohs when, you know, there were no pharaohs before. And the matrilineal line carried on through the dynastic period of Egypt. But the Mayan calendar is also a key, because the beginning of the Mayan calendar marked the beginning of the patriarchal era in Egypt, 3113 BC and the first dynasty. And so all of the secrets that I have come to recognize happened before then. But all of the traditional Egyptology is looking within the dynastic period. And so we're kind of cross-referencing and missing what's super important. And there's a couple of other things that have come up recently, which is the cleaning of the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, which used to look like it was covered in espresso coffee. And now it's bright colors. And we can see an entire map of the cosmology and the biology and the physics of what was going on in ancient Egypt. So the code is highly scientific and sitting right under our eyes. And I think that we need to be looking at the physical evidence, looking at the symbols that are embedded within the clues that the ancient Egyptians left us. And we need to stop listening to the traditional story that Egyptologists have been telling us.
And you're working with William Henry on a kind of video book called Lost Keys of the Sacred Feminine, Decoding Dendera, which you are working on at the moment. So it's... you're basically saying it's all fine to look at 3000 onwards, 3000 BC onwards, but the mysteries are there before. And these mysteries have to do with the divine feminine. Now, the divine feminine is something like Christ consciousness or other fancy words, which means something different to everybody else. So what to you is the divine feminine?
Okay. First of all, the matriarchy is not the opposite of patriarchy, where women are dragging men around by their hair. Matriarchy insists on a balance between the masculine and the feminine, and the premise is that we leave more to the children, that the children honor the wisdom of the elders, but that the children are the promise of evolution. And so we wouldn't use up everything on the planet and deplete the resources because we need to leave more for the children. So it's a completely different philosophy and mindset. And so the ancient Egyptians insisted on a balance between the sacred masculine and the sacred feminine. And what this means is that a woman has an internalized masculine and a man has an internalized feminine, but the patriarchy's agenda has been to erase evidence of everything other than itself. Lop off the feminine, babies were born out of Zeus's head, never mind. And so it's not about an imbalance, because the way the brain functions, the two hemispheres of the brain, one is masculine, one is feminine. But there's the corpus callosum, that's the connection between the two. And the ancient Egyptians were well aware that nothing can happen in terms of spiritual development without the balance. And one of the ways we see this in Egypt is over the entrance of every temple is a winged disc, which contains within it the solar energy, which is the sun disc, the wings of Nekbet, who is the sacred feminine, who's represented as a vulture, and the snake of Wadjet, which is the sacred masculine. And so when when the populace would come to the temple, they would have to surrender their lower self to their higher self in order to walk through and do spiritual work. Well, this is all a metaphor. And so our society is driven by ego, by I've got more, I have power over you, and also blood from death, instead of blood from life. And so in ancient times, the highest form of DNA was recognized, and it's menstrual blood. But in all the things that are feminine, the demonization of Mary Magdalene, the patriarchy has systematically made everything feminine negative. And I know that it's coming back now, and the feminine is reemerging. But there's been a misinterpretation of who the goddess was, who Hathor is, and how the feminine was honored. And we see this in many, many symbols, notably the left foot forward, slightly forward. So there's a balance, but the left foot is maybe half an inch forward when you see the characters in profile. And that means we're in balance, but we slightly lead with the feminine, which means that we honor what's unseen, what's not specific, what's in symbols, what's in dreams, and what comes to us from the spirit realm. So high-level initiates were human divining rods, I say. Just the way a divining rod or a pendulum can pick up on energy, that something's opening and moving into a positive state of acceptance or moving into a contraction. Our nerves don't touch each other. The neural synapses generate a hormone. The brain communicates, and then we have the ability to lift our hand or do whatever. And so the telluric energy of the earth needed to be conducted into the cosmic energy. The cosmic energy needed to be grounded into the earth, and the high-level initiates actually were the conduits for that. And we don't have that concept anymore. So the entire system of energy, free energy, was completely operational, and it was such a long time ago that it's difficult for us to put the clues back together. But if you really look at the details and take enough time to examine how the pyramid fields would have worked together, the evidence is there.
So let's paint a picture here. The traditional picture says we have temple complexes in ancient Egypt. At some points, these temple complexes were linked with pyramids. We imagine there to be hundreds, sometimes thousands, of male Egyptian priests running around, doing all kinds of ceremonies, taking care and preparing for the pharaoh, praying for his soul if he is already dead, or preparing to pray for his soul if he's still alive, while advising him at the same time in matters of state. That's the standard accepted view of ancient Egypt. What picture would you paint as to what really was going on in ancient Egypt?
Okay, so first of all, what you've just said may be true, particularly in the later dynasties where it was more male dominated. But the earlier dynasties, that's not how it worked. And so even in the dynastic period, the pharaoh had to marry the daughter of the pharaoh before him, because they were going through the MT mitochondrial DNA, and the matrilineal line still existed. And so the other thing is that there were certain periods of time where the energy from the past was percolating back up. And notably, this would have been Queen Hatshepsut, who then became a pharaoh in her own right, and the Amarna period with Nefertiti, Akhenaten, and Tut, where they were remembering something from the distant past and trying to bring it forward. And so gradually things became more and more corrupt, and the Amun priesthood was controlling everything, making people pay half their harvest to the temple to ensure proper burial for themselves that was emulating the kind of burial that they were offering the pharaoh. Though there were never pharaohs buried or had tombs in pyramids, ever, ever, ever. And that doesn't stop anybody from projecting that as an idea. So if we erase the board and yet keep the parts that were percolating back up from the distant past, the picture that I would paint, and let's imagine even 50,000 years ago here. So it's something that we almost have to practice thinking about something that's that much older, that we're erasing the board. The energy is completely different. We're in a golden age where things are more refined, where people are more conscious, where consciousness is the highest value. So there would have been certain groups of people who were farmers, who were just the regular populace. But then there was a class of high-level initiates, and they were priests and priestesses that were trained separately. And they would go through various initiations, starting with the temples along the Nile. Now, the other thing is, just like Catholic churches are often built on top of pagan temples, on top of other sacred places from the distant past, a lot of the Egyptian temples are built on top of much, much older structures. And so in the ancient, ancient times, the initiates would bring themselves to the temple. They would be trained. They would have special diets. They would learn meditation. They would learn control, and they would learn to be able to handle large amounts of energy. And the feminine was trained in one way and the masculine was trained in the other. But when they really did their rituals, they would bring it together, and the energy between them, the yin and the yang, would create more energy. And it was all done through similar things like Tantra. But they were trained in sex magic. So you'd go through the different chakras. So it would start at the base chakra at the temple of Isis and move on, where they would then process their fears, the way they would digest fear. And that would happen at Kamumbo, when they would swim with crocodiles, and it went on. So the initiates had to reach certain levels of accomplishment in order to move on. But they would do the 8 levels of initiation on their own, and then they would arrive at what I call the Band of Peace, which is the pyramid fields that go north and south of the Giza Plateau. So when most people think about Egypt, they think about the Great Pyramid and the few pyramids around the Sphinx. But actually, there's a group of 22 pyramids that actually have sky-ground correlation to a series of stars above. And they would arrive in the vision that I have. They would arrive naked, blindfold, bare feet. They'd step off the barges. The river would run right in front of the pyramids. They would be given a robe, and they would know that they would never leave this place. And the 9th level of initiation, they had to be powered up into it through the high priestess, one at a time, in chambers underneath the 2nd pyramid, which was known as the main pyramid at the time, that's connected to the Grand Causeway and the Sphinx Temple and the Sphinx itself. After the 9th level of initiation, where they were literally supercharged, comparable to taking a plug and sticking it in the wall and then the light can go on. After this, they had the capability of the transmutation of the atom, which is where the East Indian idea of siddhis, S-I-D-H-I-S, came from. Once we're mostly water, if we can transmute the atom, we are actually transmuting the water atom within ourselves, the water molecule. And I think that this is what they were able to do, which is what gave power. And Chris Dunn talks about the water molecule being blown into hydrogen and oxygen. Well, the ancient initiates, once they had the 9th level of initiation, were able to have telepathy, manifestation. They could grasp alchemy, bilocation, teleportation, and I always forget one when I do the list of 6. But the idea is that they would take one form and turn it into something else. They would be able to connect with a thought. And there were temple cats all around, large cats, panthers. and they would be able to control them with their minds. And then these cats patrolled this whole area of the Band of Peace, and if the populace approached, they could get their wild side back on. But as long as they were in the company of the high-level initiates, they were with them. And so this idea of enlightenment and of ascension and of DNA, 12-strand DNA, and 360 senses and enlightened beings, like full-fledged operational beings, being able to feed this energy that was able to go all the way around the planet in the worldwide grid that was centralized at the Giza Plateau, made for an incredible power that actually fueled the earth, was a food for the people's emotional bodies and their spiritual bodies. And so it was almost like a human generation machine that worked with the rock structures, and it sustained a beautiful peace on the planet. And so we've dismantled this to the point where we've got five senses and two strands of DNA, and it's almost impossible without some kind of modeling and understanding for us to even begin to fathom how the ancients really would have operated.
Okay, so before we go on to that bit, let's throw in something else in the mix, which is your current book, Angels and Archetypes, an Evolutionary Map of Feminine Consciousness. So we all know about angels, we all know about archetypes, but where would they fit into this picture? How do they fit in?
Okay, if consciousness is the highest value, then we need to understand ourselves. And mostly, our society is based on distraction. When the psyche can't resolve an issue, it seeks distraction. So shopping, television, overeating, alcoholism, all that kind of stuff. But to really be able to harness ourselves and become conscious of all the different aspects of ourselves takes a certain amount of study and meditation and self-awareness. And so an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness is going through its numerology, tarot, and astrology, which are the ancient arts that were practiced by the Egyptians that then had to go underground when the patriarchy started and they were killing everybody who had these kinds of beliefs. And so these beliefs have really been driven out of us. But when we look at an astrological wheel, there's 12 signs, and they are either cardinal, fixed, or mutable, which is the different seasons. So cardinal means it's initiating, so we're starting in spring, the seeds. Fixed means we're just riding through the center of this period, and then mutable, we're getting ready to change the seasons. But then they're paired with earth, air, fire, and water, and so that's how you get each of the astrological signs. So you'll get a fire, mutable, and so on. But each of these different aspects represent a different archetype within us. And if we're going to have a full range of consciousness, then we need to be able to embrace all of these different figures. And so if we're just run by one archetype, like the Persephone daughter, for example, that can lead to a woman being bulimic. There's certain different things that if we're not embracing all the different pieces, or if we drop one of the ribbons of the 22 archetypes, then it can start to run us psychologically. So all of what I'm talking about is like 360 senses, a full sphere of awareness, full consciousness, and everything in our society compartmentalizes, shuts pieces down, hides and makes secrets of certain things. One hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing. And we're just in a completely different picture than they were in.
Absolutely. We are all about isolationists rather than just the expansive view. So where do the angels come in? Are the angels somewhat similar to the Christian angels? Or how would you describe them?
Well, what I've done in the book is each archetype, her higher self is an angel. And so these are the spiritual lessons. And so if you go into the book, you can just read all the angels, and that's a spiritual journey. Or you can read all the archetypes, and that's a psychological journey. But it's giving us the metaphor that once we fully understand the terrestrial psychological aspects, then we have an opening to go up into the spiritual realms, which is what the ancient Egyptians were completely conversant in, and what we've shut down. What we've done is we've switched out the cultural myth. And so It used to be through Gnostic traditions, and the Nag Hammadi texts show us this, which are down the road from Dendera. You pass right through Nag Hammadi on the way. And this is where the Temple of Hathor is, which was a training center for the feminine. And so the cultural myth now is that we have an old man who's in the sky with a thunderbolt or a lightning bolt who's going to strike us down, who we are supposed to have faith in, that the empowerment of God is outside of ourselves and we need to pay priests, we need to go to confession, we need to make ourselves pure, and we better follow the rules or he's going to strike us down, and he's dissociated from us. He's not even on the earth. But the cultural myth before that was Gaia Sophia, Mother Earth, was the planet, and that she has faith in us, and it's a co-creative thing, and that we together create something positive. So we're constructing our reality as opposed to deconstructing it. Like even in school, we deconstruct Shakespeare, we critique, but we're not building anything. And that's kind of like the U.S. economy right now. It's pushing paper around and people get money from exchanges, but we're not building anything, right? And so it's a completely different worldview. But by switching out the cultural myth, it's allowed us to, it's a very serious thing because it's allowed us to model ourselves on something that I think is false. And so by returning to the earth, by reconnecting to nature, then we somehow have the empowerment from within. So we don't have to pay somebody, which is why the situation with the Amun priesthood collecting half of everybody's harvest to ensure their salvation when they died just doesn't work, because we shouldn't have to pay for any of this. You know, to me, utilities and interest and insurance is false. It's and even taxes. It's something that's created. We can live without money, and we can live without our own, within our own personal empowerment, and that's what we should be doing. And so the angelic realm is how we connect to the spiritual ourselves, not by going to church, not by thinking the priest has it and we don't, not by paying money for it, by truly being conscious enough to allow for the spiritual energy to be ours. And that's what these spiritual lessons are in the book.
Now, you were hinting at the cycles of time, the Mayan calendar, 3113 BC to next year. You were saying how basically the divine feminine was taken out of the equation more and more in that cycle. People like Walter Crittenden, and I believe you've spoken at his conference, they are trying to paint a picture which basically says that we go through cycles of time, and really these are predetermined, whereby certain cycles will have certain emphases, and other cycles will have different ones. The more standard point of view, I think, about history is that things are done by people. So if you were to say that the divine feminine disappeared at a certain moment in time, people will want to know who killed her or who got rid of her presence. So where do you stand on this topic?
Well, thank you for that question. And I also honor what Walter Crittenden has brought us. He wrote a book called Lost Star of Myth and Time, and was looking at the mythology of different cultures and the idea that we may be in a binary star system was serious. And what's so is that one of the shafts in the Great Pyramid always points to Sirius. And someone like, I've argued with Robert Beauvau, he says, how can that be true if everything's spinning around everywhere? But if, in fact, we are in a binary system, just simply the way some people are single and some people are in couples, some stars are single and some stars are in a binary system. So Walter researched everything in mythology. But then I took what he had said and went into Starry Night Pro and looked at Sirius with the extragalactic grid, and the entirety of our system flows around it. And Sirius is always in the center of this. And so it makes sense that that shaft could point to that. And so the site north of Giza is Abu Roush, which represents Sirius, and then Orion is represented on the plateau, and then the Pleiades further down. Well, those three star systems never separate. And so if you look at the orbit of Sirius and the binary orbit with our sun, If you can imagine two ovals coming together in the middle, and I'm waving my hands and we're on the radio and that doesn't help, but when we're closest together, it's a golden age. And when we're farthest apart, it's the Iron Age, the Dark Age. And so as we approach to come back to the center, there's an acceleration. And as we move farther away and we're going back out, it's a deceleration. And so we have been in the time of deceleration, and we are at the bottom of the negative energy of the dark, dark, dark cycle. And even in the five major cycles of time in ancient Egypt, Amun, and we still say Amen, and the Amun priesthood were the corrupt ones at the end, is the dark. And then it turns the corner and goes to Heper, which is the dawn. And so what's true, it seems, is that it takes 13,000 years to go all the way out and 13,000 years to come back, which directly corresponds with the precessional cycle of the equinoxes, which is roughly 26,000 years. So 13 to deteriorate the energy and 13 to build the energy. Where we are in time right now is the turning point. But many, many cycles, the billion year cycles and the millions of year cycles are coming, and the Mayan cycle, they're all coming to a zero point at the same time, which is almost like a ladder of ascension. All the chakras lining up, and we can start to turn to an accelerated time. Now, I use the metaphor of winter solstice as we are approaching, particularly in the northern hemisphere and the northern countries. As we get closer and closer to winter solstice, it's darker and darker, and every day is a little darker. And it feels like it's kind of compressing upon us, and we're lighting candles and putting up our Christmas tree with little lights. And then we hit the solstice, the dark point, and then we start to get a little bit more light every day. Well, 3 days before solstice, we feel oppressed. But 3 days after solstice, we're like, oh, yay, the light's coming back. I feel better. And what I'm saying is it's the direction that we're moving in. And this is what's significant about our time period. So the exact galactic alignment with our sun in the center of the dark rift of the Milky Way is sunset, December 21st, 2012. And I've got a group booked to be between the paws of the Sphinx at that time. But October 28th was when the Mayan calendar, the karmic part of the Mayan calendar, was supposed to end, if we're listening to Johann Kalman. So we're in a corridor right now where it's a co-creative free fall, is what I'm calling it, where we have the chance to upgrade our DNA. The karmic part of the cycle is over. And if we're not finished, I'm not sure what's going to happen. So we're moving between these cycles. And so it's, like I said earlier, it's really hard for us to think about a precessional cycle, 26,000 years. We're not trained to think that way. But when you think two precessional cycles, three precessional cycles, that's taking us in to the distant past, which may be, you know, where all these clues are coming from that you see on Ancient Aliens that I've seen you on.
Yes, you have indeed seen me on Ancient Aliens. And before we go into Aliens, basically, the interesting aspect there is that we are in a time which I think is where, you know, you see the signs happening, and to some extent the patriarchy is collapsing, in the sense that they have no clue what to do with books like Dan Brown. As simplistic as it might seem, a book called The Da Vinci Code, which asks a few questions of Mary Magdalene, receives blank stares from the Vatican, an organization which, you know, a few hundred years ago was able to kill tens of thousands of people if they so wanted to, but in 2003 or 2004 or whenever they were asked to comment on it, they basically couldn't. They were kind of like stumbling over themselves trying to come up with an interpretation, which kind of like shows that, as you're saying, that the old world no longer is working, and that a new world is dawning. And yes, definitely, if the old karma of the old world has to be made redundant by the 21st of December 2012, it seems that what is happening right now in Europe is definitely happening on an extremely fast pace, and if not a very scary ride. So it's said that the Mayans, I believe it was Eric Thompson and or Frank Walters, who said that the cycles of the Mayans, the first three cycles had been about the physical development of mankind. The cycle we were in was about spiritual development of mankind. The next cycle, where are we going to? What is kind of like the ambition? Clearly, the current system has some minor, if not major, problems. Spirituality is slowly making inroads again, but at the same time, I feel that spirituality is creeping in rather than this tidal wave, which you could also expect. So what is kind of like the spiritual forecast for the next few years?
I really like your questions, and I know you're approaching it from a well-researched position. Okay, the way I see it is that the system still has us in a stranglehold. The old system has to fall, and it's like they're holding a waterfall up with toothpicks, and they can keep bailing it out, and it's all about delusion and lies, and people expect to be lied to, and they expect the government's lying to them. And so this waterfall surge of spirituality is what's happening within the people. This is the Occupy Everything. And I understand now they're going to occupy the Vatican. And people are saying enough's enough. We know that the system is rigged. We know that 1% of the people get all the money and everybody else suffers. Well, that's wrong because it's supposed to be equal for everybody. And humanity knows that. I've traveled to 52 countries. Egypt counts as one. I'm on my way there in 2 days for the 26th time. Everyone on the planet wants the same thing, love and respect. So the people are ready. The people are getting more psychic, more spiritual, more able to see what's true. And the other thing is voice activation, which is why I think people are enjoying radio interviews, because you can tell if somebody's sincere. And if you're looking at them, you can almost tell if they're lying because they're blinking. And so we've got this spiritual thing, and then we've got this bottleneck holding on to us that's called the government. All the governments in the world are corrupt, and all of the people running the governments are putting the money of the people's money in their own pocket. And this is what we had during the All Moon Priesthood. And at the end of grace or every prayer, we say amen. And so in some ways, we're blinded to this. What's scheduled to happen is that they can't hang on anymore. Now, when you think about Congress, they meet in rooms with no windows, with no plants. They get in limousines. They don't go down to Skid Row and see people living on the street. They're like a God himself living in a cloud, completely separated and not grounded in nature, grounded on the ground. Now, one key point here is that the ancient Suf word for the pyramid was Per Neter, which means the house of nature. And so many people are nature deprived, toxic. Their pineal glands have been calcified, which is the connection to spirituality through fluoride. The powers, we used to call them the powers that be, and then we started calling them the powers that were, and now we're calling them the powers that pretend. They have nothing except all the power. And they'll kill, you said tens of thousands of people. They killed millions of people, more people than in World War II were killed in the witch trials. And then when they'd killed everybody, they moved on to the missions. And all of this is to superimpose an artificial thing that steals all the resources and leaves all the people impoverished. And it's got to end. And the people are standing up. And so if the stranglehold of the patriarchal ways of being and thinking is released, in some way, people can stand up. Like in Egypt, where the police said, I'm not killing my brother. And the police went home and put their plain clothes on and came back. That's what we need, is for the police to say, I'm not doing the dirty work of Wall Street anymore. So when and if they'll let go, I think the flood, literally like the floodgates break and the spiritual waters just come pouring in. But then we need to regroup. And we don't really have a model for an empowered humanity. But I maintain, and I said it already, all interest is fake. Utilities, forget it. They should be free. And we get controlled by utility companies. Taxes, we don't need them. And the taxes we pay half our income to income tax, and it goes to pay the bankers. Interest on money they created out of nothing. Okay, and insurance. If you have something and you need insurance, medical or house insurance, they say, no, we don't cover that. But yet you can't buy a house without it. So that's what has to fall. And imagine if you and your family and your extended family got all the money they ever paid for those four things back, you'd have over $1 million. And so that's how the system has us in a stranglehold. And so if the, and we need to forget bailing out the banks, let them fall. So if all of that collapses, we need less government, because, and in the Gnostic tradition, you didn't have to control people. You didn't have to police people and give them a ticket if they didn't wear a bicycle helmet. People would say, okay, I either want to protect my head or I don't. Here's a consequence. I wear it because I want to, or I don't. And so, if we return to a spirituality, then we return to a morality. If we honor our own children, then we're not going to kill somebody else's kids. And so it's only by dissociation, by compartmentalizing the brain, by playing video games your whole life, and then you get a video game and you're actually dropping real bombs on real people. We've got to stop killing. Gather up all the guns and melt them down and make statues of angels in the park. Like, there's profit in hurting people. And it's only a few people who are getting that. So if they can come down and hopefully, you know, be called up and tried, I think the rest of us know what to do. And it's only that control that's stopping us.
Well, I will say the wise words of, I have forgotten the name of who it was, but he was a professor. And he basically was asked as to how the Roman Empire fell. And he said, well, you know, for 300 years before the Roman Empire actually fell, it was in a position of falling. It was just that the people didn't realize that it was that they could top it. And so for 300 years, the myth of the Roman Empire consisted and basically left people in power. But over that period of 300 years, it could have fallen at any moment in time if the people realized what it was. And I think we're in that frame of mind almost, whereby people are protesting, but not really realizing the power they have. Very picturesque depiction of this was, I think it was 1990 or 1991, and the farmers were protesting in Brussels, and I was on my way for some appointment through the streets of Brussels the day before the farmers of all across Europe were going to descend on Brussels to once again protest against EU regulations, which they felt were disastrous to their purposes. And the police was everywhere. They were putting up fences. They were putting up water cannons. And the one thing which could have happened that day, which would have changed the world forever, was if those police officers basically pointed the direction of the water cannons and closed certain exits as entrances and vice versa. And the government protecting at that moment in time would be completely isolated. And to some extent, you're beginning to see that with people. The overarching image I have of the Iraqi protest was several years ago when on the streets of London there were 2 million people. Well, if those 2 million people had realized that relatively peacefully they could have taken England back to their own purposes if they so wanted to, that would have happened. So I think there is indeed this thing of realization and to some extent this spiritual revolution which we're waiting for, I think actually needs to really start just quite basically. It just needs to make people realize that together we are strong against a literal minority. So bringing in another topic, you were mentioning aliens, ancient aliens, and you and I are going to share something which is a publisher called New Page Book, because you are working on a book called Aliens in Ancient Egypt, Close Encounters and Secrets of the Nile Civilization. Now, I'm going to ask you a question which every radio show is asking me, which is basically this. You have just been describing this beautiful civilization called Ancient Egypt. You have spoken about the empowered people in there, the empowered women in that civilization. And then everybody is, well, not everybody, but the standard historians are going to ask the standard question, which is, isn't all of this invalidated if you bring the concept of aliens about? Is aliens not once again this patriarchal overlord civilizing power which we paint on top of a beautiful civilization of Egypt as you've just painted it?
Hey, that's a good one. I'm really liking this. Okay. If we are looking at everything through patriarchal lenses, then we will also look at aliens that way. If we look underneath things and see who's doing what and how aliens perhaps were, you know, if there was a crash ship and they reverse engineered and, you know, all of the abductions could have been the secret government doing that. Then we see fire coming from the sky, power from above, the rape of humanity and the changes of DNA by outside forces. Well, isn't that a patriarchal way of looking at aliens? And then you see it, I'm sorry, I'm going to say ejaculation fantasies and explosions and fire and power from the masculine and the disempowerment of people. Well, isn't that metaphorically kind of like God being outside with the thunderbolt and the lightning and striking us down? So if we erase the patriarchal board and go and step over somewhere in a time of more balance, then what's an alien? Well, and what were the gods that the real ancients prior to the dynastic period were into? Well, one of the things that's not talked about and that's not accepted since the witch trials drove, like I said, tarot, numerology, astrology underground, is the idea of speaking to a benevolent alien. The Pleiadians and the Arcturians and various kind, wise, disincarnate spirits that are teachers, ancestral teachers. Laird Scranton says we were taught civilization from outside forces. There's many ways of looking at that. And as we become more spiritual, we meditate, we have intuition, we feel guided, we go to channeled sessions, and all of those are coming from outside of ourselves, perhaps, but they're benevolent and they're soft. And if we're in a receptive feminine place, if you will, we can receive this knowledge. Now with digital cameras, we're able to photograph these plasma beings and spiritual entities, and they're on my website, pyramidcode.com. And they exist, but the system that's had us by the stranglehold has got about four different corporations, which is four CEOs running the media, movies, magazines, newspapers, television. They go, no, that's not happening, okay? So when you look at the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera, and if you talk to William Henry, we're talking wormholes, stargates, a science where things are popping in and out where we weren't able to do that before. Bilocation and teleportation are about moving the Ka around. So when you look at Hatshepsut, she says that in the early part of the 18th dynasty, that her father shapeshifted. An entity came into her father, impregnated her mother, and therefore she was starseed. Now, that was ridiculed, just the way Akhenaten and Nefertiti, I mean, he was sick and deformed and weird and all that. But what they all had, Akhenaten, Nefertiti, Hatshepsut, Tut, they had distended skulls, which gave more room for an increased size of the pineal gland, which allowed them to make contact with these spiritual beings in a positive way, not on a ship that's going to strike you down and, you know, abduct you and give you implants. Not that kind of alien, okay? And so they're alien in that they're a different kind of DNA. But the DNA is a very interesting thing, and there's lots of tests going on now, you know, with how DNA can be shared, and if you're projecting a different kind of animal, a frog onto a duck or whatever, that'll get frog feet instead of duck feet. And so we don't really understand what DNA, but everything's been controlled. Everything in school's been controlled, compartmentalized. But when we start to blend these sorts of pieces of information and look to see, it could be that these aliens are part of our extended DNA. And they're us. And if I started having past life recall as a little girl and everything that I've gone looking for has checked out eventually, sometimes it took me 10 years to find it, why can't it be us that came from the Pleiades and that we remember? See, reincarnation was outlawed by the Council of Nicaea in 323 AD. Well, We recycle everything else. Why can't we recycle our souls? How can we learn all the lessons on earth in one life? So if you think about how everything's been orchestrated over long, long periods of time, and people like Jordan Maxwell have helped with that to help us understand how the symbols and the church and the Vatican, everybody's done all of this compartmentalization so that we can't get this. But you know what? We're getting it anyway. And so this inner terrestrial, as Graham Hancock talks about, we reach the fourth dimension and many dimensions. Like every dimension passes through your house and mine right now. But some people access it on the third dimension. Some people can be accessing it on the 11th dimension. And so this isn't a conversation that we've been allowed to have. And yet if you look at internet, it's, you know, full of things that talk about this, but that doesn't get into the mainstream. So I think that Ancient Aliens is really a nice bridge for a lot of these concepts. And it asks a lot of questions. It's could it be, and that kind of thing. It's not saying it is, which is what patriarchy does. However, I still think there's a little bit of a patriarchal flair to it. And maybe that's why it's allowed to be on history television. But there is a whole inside job, if you will, internal place. Now, internet's our best friend because it's the democratization of information. And of course, the powers that pretend are trying to shut that down too. But that's the secret. That's the bridge. That's how the veil gets lifted.
Yes, and you know, there are several things to kind of like discuss on the Ancient Aliens thing. One of them is that actually the producers tried to get women on the show, but that quite often they have great difficulty in finding or identifying them. And the one thing I think is that history as such has been so defined through a narrow focus that it's almost like the image of the Matrix comes to mind, where Neo realizes that he will never bring it down except by becoming it and then kind of like exploding it from the inside. And to some extent, the big message actually of Ancient Aliens in media is that it's showing that groups of what people thought they were interested in and what gets aired, that they have it completely wrong. And this has to do with television format, this yes versus no debate, which is so prevalent on so many television shows, but also the fact that you know, like, there's this idea that television is escapism, that people only watch it because they have a hard life and then they want to escape from it. And to a large extent, the History Channel as a whole, because it's become quite a top rated channel these days, is actually showing that it is not the case, that people watch TV to actually learn. And as bizarre as that might seem to our listeners, for media gonzos out there, it's a revelation that people watch television to learn. It's a complete new thought. So we have a few minutes left, and I basically want to kind of ask, we've already spoken about what's going to happen in the next few years, where do we come from, what is ancient Egypt, but there is this thing, and there was one word which you mentioned, which is also Kathleen's favorite word, which is remember. We are attracted to Egypt, to its powers, to its pyramids, because there's something which is attracting us there. As you're pointing out, you're on your 26th visit there. Several other people just look at it and they remember. Ancient Aliens, I think, is popular with people because it also, you know, when it is attractive, it makes you remember. So how do we help the people how to remember? What is there to remember? What is this? What is there to remember, and how can we help remembering?
Well, what we need to remember is that empowerment comes from within, and what's coming from without is disempowerment, and it's the most natural thing, and that's why people are so interested in it. And so we need to trigger that, but the most important thing that triggers things is modeling. So if you see someone who's normalizing the idea of remembering past lives, who has channeled and feels quite good about being a conscious channel, who can trust, that some entities from outside can be dark forces and some can be just the way we choose our friends. Some people feel negative and some people feel positive. That things that are unseen are normal. And that, you know, what the brain has been shut down on the whole feminine side of the brain. They didn't just, you know, chastise Mary Magdalene. They chastised the whole side of the brain that's symbolic and dream time. And our society has been, if you don't see it, it's not there. And so as more of us know, it increases the knowing of other people. But as long as it's funneling through the television, as you said, a lot of young people aren't watching television because it's not interactive. And you can interact with the computer and say, no, I'm bailing, or wait, pause, I'm going to get a cup of tea. Television just feeds it to you. And that's why I was told, my spiritual guidance was that the pyramid code had to be on TV. Because if we get damaged on TV, then we need to get healed on TV. And of course people want to learn. This business about being distracted is for a minority of people. Most people are totally inspired by the idea of connecting. And so as more people connect, that's what's happening, though. The veils are thinner. So you can look at somebody sitting on a plane next to you and they're a blue-collar truck driver, but they know. And they've listened to Coast to Coast AM or wherever we're getting our information now. And so modeling. The more of us who know, the more knowing will happen. And knowing is a very great power, as Hakim says on the Pyramid Code. To know that we know that we know. That's an internal muscle. If we ask the question and listen, but knowing in our culture is getting the answer right on the test, figuring out what the teacher thinks the answer is. And that's not deep knowing. So those sorts of things are very much in our favor.
Absolutely. And Carmen, thank you for being a guest on the show. Some highlights, we will all be posting this on our own website, thespiritrevolution.com. But first of all, your website is pyramidcode.com. You have a book out. Let's start with the Pyramid Code. It's a 5-set DVD, which you can get in an awful lot of places. We will post links to that as well. Your current book is Angels and Archetypes, an Evolutionary Map of Feminine Consciousness. You are working together with William Henry on The Lost Keys of the Sacred Feminine, Decoding Dendera. And then in May of next year, you will have the publication of Aliens in Ancient Egypt, Close Encounters and Secrets of the Nile Civilization, which basically means that everybody is now going to log off and go to Amazon and start looking at these entries. So, Carmen, thank you for being our guest. If you enjoyed our radio show, you can repeat it. You can listen to it on the BBS Radio Archives. There is a small fee there, which gives you access not just to our shows, but to all the radio shows which are on BBS Radio. You can, however, listen to this show for free in a number of ways. One of them is by downloading this from iTunes. It's a free download, and you cannot just listen to our show, but also to various other shows. In fact, 18 months of it, including, for example, Walter Crittenden's show, the interview we did a few months ago, which Carmen was talking about. And the other means is going to thespiritrevolution.com, the home of the Spirit Revolution, where you can listen to the last 5 shows, and you can also see an overview of all the shows we have done, which is almost 2 full years of shows there. So until the next time, which is next week, from myself and once again stepping into Kathleen's shoes, I would say the truth against the world.